It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we'll discuss the situation in the Middle East and the challenges that Donald Trump will face in that volatile region as president. My guest is Steve Grand, Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the nonpartisan think tank, the Atlantic Council. Grand will speak tomorrow, Tuesday, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Steve Grand, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure.
The Atlantic Council has a new report on the Middle East, just released as a result of a two-year study chaired by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She was Secretary of State under President Clinton. Also, a former National Security Advisor and head of the National Security Council, Stephen Hadley. He worked under President George W. Bush. This was a report to focus on ways to achieve stability and growth in the Middle East. What were the main findings?
Our main findings were, I think the headline was that there's a lot more to work with in the region than we expected when we set out on this. Everyone's familiar with the violence and the sectarianism and the extremism that has dominated at least the headlines about the region for quite some time. But we also found another narrative, which is that there are a tremendous number of people, particularly young people and women, who are taking the future into their own hands and are empowered, are educated, are connected to the world, and are trying to change their own lives, change their own communities, in some cases change their own countries. And so we saw these green shoots of change, which we think offer some real promise for the future. And one of the things we were also encouraged by is we think that some of governments are seeing and recognizing both the potential and the power that these young people, that women, that entrepreneurial folk have, and how much they can contribute to positive change in the region. And some countries are beginning to take steps to enable that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what you just called the green shoots of change. Can you give us some examples? You mentioned young people, women. What specifically did your report find?
It's people who are engaged in their communities, who are not waiting for government to fix their problems, but banding together and trying to find local solutions to local problems. It's young, savvy entrepreneurs who are using new technologies to develop high-tech startups in many cases that have been quite successful and prosperous across the region. It's women in Egypt, for example, coming up with a program that crowdsources harassment and alerts police to instances, and women as well, to instances and places where harassment is taking place, so that women can be safer.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's those.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the threats that you identified in this study.
Well, you know, on the negative side of the ledger, what's clearly been happening in the region is you have this more empowered citizenry who wants more, in part because of globalization and because of the internet and social media. They're able to compare much better than before what's happening in their countries versus that in other countries. And they're demanding more of governments. And some governments have governed quite badly over time in the region and corruptly. And citizens are not going to stand for that any longer. And so you have some instances where states have not only governed badly and not been able to meet the expectations of their citizens, but where states have actually failed. And you've seen in those cases of state failure, these civil wars emerge. And the civil wars are not really the cause of the region's problems, but they've been a major accelerant of the problems we see in the region. They've opened the door for ISIS and Al-Qaeda to come in. They have created heightened sectarian feeling between Sunnis and Shia in the region. They've created a lot of death and destruction, and they've created these tremendous refugee flows that have been so destabilizing to the region, but also to Europe, and even to the politics here in the United States.
The report says that, in the words of the report, to quote it, the days of external powers trying to orchestrate and even dictate political reality in the region, in the Middle East, are finished. I wonder if the report identified a turning point, the events that convince you at the Atlantic Council that this is the case, that there is a different set of circumstances there now that the U.S. has to deal with.
Yeah, we really think, we propose a new strategic approach to the region that's more one of partnership rather than a great power sort of telling people in the region what to do. For many years, the Europeans tried that, and we probably are guilty of it in coming after them in doing the same. And I don't think that ever quite worked very well, and it's certainly not appropriate to the moment today. Arab people in particular are really determined to create their own destiny. And what we heard often as we traveled through the region from leaders and from publics were phrases like, we're ready, we're shaping a vision, let us lead. That doesn't mean that they don't need help. Help in particular in ending these violent civil wars and in tamping down the sectarianism that's become such a problem in the region. But they are determined to forge a new kind of Middle East. People, I think, to get to your question, I think because of the internet, because of globalization, because of education, higher education levels, are much more prepared to take their own futures in their hands. And governments seem to be waking up in the region to that. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain political moment there right now where we feel a different kind of approach to the region might just lead to something far better than what we've seen in mm-hmm. recent years.
A different approach, a help, that is the tricky part here, really, isn't it? What is the nature of that help? What should be the nature of that help so that it actually does facilitate an evolution of these countries into a better place and not be interpreted as a sort of a neo-colonial involvement, right?
Right. Well, you know, we started out this project with great humility because this is a really complex challenge, and we listened a lot. And I think that's sort of the starting point where the United States should begin is by listening, by letting the region itself begin to shape a vision, begin to act on that vision, but making clear that we are willing to be there as a partner in supporting countries that are willing to take risks for change, and also in helping them address the violence and begin to wind down the violence that has been so destabilizing to the region. If you think about all these green shoots that I talked about, all this positive, useful energy and new activity that's going on in the region, none of that's going to be able to really spread and blossom in conditions of warfare and instability. There needs to be a certain minimum level of security and stability for the kinds of investments we think are important in human capital to take root.
If you've just joined us, Steve Grand is my guest this half hour, Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the nonpartisan think tank, the Atlantic Council. Steve will be speaking. He's the guest speaker tomorrow, Tuesday, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. One of the tasks in this report, it took 2 years to research and put together, is to better deal with the problems of refugees. What is the answer? How does this report recommend attacking the unprecedented level of refugees?
Well, I think step one is recognizing that it's the civil wars that are creating these tremendous refugee flows. People are choosing to cross borders and seek refuge elsewhere because conditions at home are just so awful. And if we can wind down these civil wars, if we can find political settlements that are inclusive and that are just and that are enforceable over time, a lot of the impetus for people to flee will go away. Secondly, we came to recognize that refugees can be a great asset for the future. In war-troubled areas like Syria, these are the people at the end of the day who, under the right conditions, are going to come back and rebuild their communities and hopefully make them more tolerant, more vibrant, and more resilient over time. So there's an opportunity, if we invest in these refugees, to turn them into a positive force rather than the very negative image that many people have of refugees. We saw in many, many different instances that where in host countries like Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon, where these refugees have access to the labor markets, are able to work, have decent housing, they become over time contributing members of society. It also means that they're more likely, these kinds of people who've been integrated into their host societies are also the very people who are most likely to go back at the end of the day and participate in the rebuilding of their own societies when the violence subsides.
Let's talk a little bit about the incoming administration. In something like 7 weeks, Donald Trump will become president of the United States, succeeding Barack Obama. How do the findings of this report compare with what you've heard, what we've heard from the president-elect about what should be done in the Middle East?
Well, you know, I think it's early, so it's hard to say what this administration will do and how they will approach the Middle East. We did not write this study for one particular party or another. We recognize that either candidate could win the elections. But we think there's much in the report that's consistent with what President-elect Trump has said about the Middle East.
For instance?
He's talked about the importance of defeating Daesh, ISIS, and I think we show how you can embed that effort within a larger strategy that makes any battlefield victories sustainable over time. There's not really a military solution to the problem of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. It needs to be embedded in a larger strategy that leads to changes in the region and how it's governed and how leaders in the region act. Mm-hmm. So that many of the grievances that provide the ideological narrative behind Al-Qaeda and ISIS go away.
Is what the report is recommending as far as involvement in this area, and U.S. military involvement and otherwise, so much different than what Barack Obama has been doing the past few years?
It builds on it, but it does say we got to do more in certain areas, and certainly in going after and defeating Daesh, ISIS, as it's also known. We feel that there's a lot more that could be done and needs to be done, and that it needs to be embedded in the larger strategy of transformation that helps these societies build more legitimate, more effective, better governed states over time.
Mm-hmm. What are you seeing in Donald Trump's cabinet choices thus far regarding Middle East policy?
Well, it suggests some nominees who are keen to focus a great deal on ISIS and Al-Qaeda. It suggests a couple people who are keen to take a tougher line against Iran. And we talk a good bit in our report about how one needs to deter and contain Iran while at the same time looking for opportunities to engage it on issues of mutual interest. And it's an administration, or at least the president-elect, who's made clear that he thinks that our friends and allies should do more. And that's really been a premise of our strategy from the beginning, that our friends and allies in the Middle East are not only able but keen to do more, and a new kind of relationship is possible where we just enable and empower those in the region to create their own destiny.
Mm-hmm. Just hours ago, Donald Trump posted a series of tweets criticizing China for monetary policy, its operations in the South China Sea. And last week, Donald Trump risked a diplomatic rift with China by speaking directly with Taiwan's president. I wonder, what are your thoughts on this unusual style of diplomacy, tweeting, for example? Is it a new, possibly effective form of diplomacy, or is it more like a bull in a china shop?
I think it depends, and we just need to see. I don't think a new administration, I think, always has the right to and is smart to try to alter the carrots and sticks they present to some of our enemies and to some of our friends, and try to sort of tweak the relationship by getting a little bit of leverage. And you know, maybe that's what he's doing with Taiwan vis-a-vis China. So I think it's perfectly legitimate and okay for a new president to try to come in and change some relationships and get a little bit more leverage in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
What I think would be dangerous and destabilizing is to walk away from the international order that the U.S. has created beginning after World War II, and that has provided a framework for how states relate to one another, and has been tremendously important in keeping the world safe and peaceful and in enlarging economic prosperity across the globe. And that is an architecture that was difficult to construct and would be a disaster to destroy. It is essential to our success as a country, and it is important to the stability of the world.
Mm-hmm. But that diplomatic protocol that's been built up doesn't necessarily rule out tweeting as a form of diplomacy.
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. You know, a new administration needs to have a consistent, coherent message. And so one needs to make sure that what one tweets is consistent with policy. But I think every new president in recent era, or every president going back to Roosevelt with his radio speeches, his fireside radio speeches, has tried to find new ways to communicate with the American public. So I don't think we should be opposed to new forms of communication with citizens.
In talking about the Middle East and the many challenges there, what are the Atlantic Council's thoughts in this study on Russia's role in the Middle East?
Sure. You know, I think, and this ties back to our discussion of the new administration. The new administration seems to be trying to recalibrate relations with Russia, and maybe that presents an opportunity to have a different kind of conversation with Russia about the Middle East, and try to find some sort of understanding with Russia about these civil wars in particular. But I think we need the Russians to recognize that an unqualified embrace of Bashar al-Assad or other authoritarian leaders in the region is not the way that you get to stability, long-term stability in the region, and not the way you address the terrorist threats that the Middle East presents at the moment.
Before we finish up, we don't have much time left, Steve, but a quick word on the Atlantic Council's position on Iran, considering the new administration.
Well, the Atlantic Council as an organization doesn't take policy positions. in this particular project, in this task force, we look closely at Iran's role in the region. And like the incoming administration, found many of Iran's aggressive foreign policies in the region destabilizing. We think, and we write in the report, that the existing nuclear agreement is in place and is probably better than any alternative at the moment. So the key in moving forward is how do you enforce that agreement and ensure that Iran abides by all the terms while at the same time containing and deterring Iran's more aggressive foreign policy actions in the region. And we think one of the ways that you can do that is by being more forceful when it comes to Syria and pushing back on Russian and Syrian government atrocities against civilians in Syria. We don't think the massive killing of civilians in Syria is helpful to resolving the conflict in Syria, and we think humanitarian protection should always come first, the defense of innocent civilians trapped in war zones.
Okay. Steve Grand, thank you very much. Executive Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the nonpartisan think tank, the Atlantic Council. Steve will be speaking tomorrow, Tuesday, before the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Steve Grand, thanks for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben. Enjoyed it greatly.